Hello and welcome to episode 220 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Chris Weston and Martin Maskelyne.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the podcast. I think there's been a lot happening this week, I guess, since the last one. Sometimes things all happen at once, and every year we've gone through to the end of the year and we've said, well, at least that year's over, and we haven't yet learned our lesson that there could be worse to come. But still, here we are. That's something at least. And how's your week been, Matt?
Well, apart from the ongoing threat of nuclear war on the European continent, it's been fine. So, yeah, it's been, apart from that, went out for a nice meal on Saturday night, all fine. How's your week been?
Oh, myself, it's been okay, actually, quite good, you know, other than the obvious. But we've been quite busy, got lots going on, new clients, things like that. So it's been good fun. The weather was quite nice at the weekend, so that was quite pleasant. And but I think you're right. It's one of those situations. But no, I have to say, an unremarkable week in many ways. Well, maybe I just can't remember it because so much has happened in the last few days, right? Maybe it's all just seems so long ago. So, Martin, how about you? How's your week been?
I mean, if indeed, other than the obvious, I think it feels extremely, extremely unreal, everything that's happening. But over the weekend, had a very nice barbecue, the first one of the year, I have to say. I quite enjoyed that. Nice sun, good food, so really did enjoy that. And then other than that, extremely busy week, where the team is growing very quickly, so we're hiring very, very fast, onboarding, and then all the business as usual, you could say. So it was a bit crazy, but yeah, I'm very much looking forward on Thursday. I'm taking a holiday, first one since a very, very long time. So actually very much looking forward to that.
Oh, good. So when you say you're hiring, it's really tough right now, right? Everybody I know is hiring, but not many people are being that successful. And last week we talked a little bit about what companies can do other than money to make themselves more attractive. Now, when you're working in a tech space and you're building product and things like that, that's attractive to many people because it's, you know, you're involved in building something and that's always got some attraction to it. So do you think you've got an advantage in finding people or do you find yourself in very strong competition?
It is incredibly tough. To put that in perspective, we've been hiring for developer advocates, a DevRel team for open source, since about 9 months now. And that's been, I've seen so many candidates. It's so, so difficult. And then we recently, just in the last mile, somebody that lives and works for a Berlin-based open source company, when it just slipped through the fingers the very last minute, so it's extremely frustrating sometimes, extremely. And other roles as well, it's definitely not easy out there right now. Startups are paying what ordinary companies today, plus a whole bunch. And I think where it does get easier is where, you know, when you build, like for us, for example, for us, we've built up, I think, a very nice culture internally. We meet now every 6 months, which seems a bit weird to say that, but we do. Last time was in Barcelona, in between waves C and COVID, of course. And then the next one is in a month from now. These things, of course, help the problem domain, very clear job descriptions, of course, and very detailed, I think we give a lot of course, ownership, and we really, like when we're hiring, we do it as a team. Like we almost overload people with conversations with everyone in the company, so they get a very good feel. Yeah, it's more selling than hiring nowadays, but it's going okay.
That's really interesting way of putting it, actually, selling rather than hiring, and actually being able to sort of show what you can add to a potential employee's career rather than what they can add to meet your needs alone, which is the kind of traditional model, I think, for a lot of organisations, of how they think about it. So you're based in Belgium, but is Soda, the company that you have co-founded, is it geographically agnostic? Are you spread everywhere? Or yeah, okay.
Yeah, so we do try to work around certain hubs, so it's easier to kind of create like a small mass of people, so it makes sense to have an office there, so you can actually go there if you still want to. But yeah, in the end, with this amount of competition, you have to do global. It's a remote first. And then for certain teams, you can make an exception. Like for certain go-to-market teams, we actually built them around certain cities or hubs. But in general, yeah, it's fully remote.
Yeah, I think it's interesting for the. It's actually, I guess, one of the other wonderful benefits of Brexit, that the fact that now for many organisations they're competing, if not on a continental scale, mm-hmm. they're competing on a completely global scale, and it feels like the UK, we're kind of just getting more and more blinkered in the way we're looking for skills and talent. And not being part of the EU now completely limits the ability to be able to have remote first teams that span outside of just the immediate country. And I think that's going to be, when there's a lot of competition going on everywhere else as well, I think it's going to become increasingly difficult for the skills to be found. So another wonderful win.
The good thing, you know, you have a lot of talent in the UK. So it's a great, I think for, we found it a bit hard to land there in the sense that to open up a shop in post-Brexit. So that was not so hard. Like for your first employee, you know, health insurance, etc. It's really hard to do for one person, things like that. But, you know, we managed. Some countries are just harder. And there's, of course, nowadays there's a growing ecosystem of tools out there that help, that kind of provides a layer in between. You know, there, some are good, some are really work well, others is a bit harder. But we always prefer to have a direct relationship in the end. So that means setting up not the company necessarily in that, but making sure at least we can hire there directly.
Yeah, no, and that is, I guess, that landing point, the first employee in a particular territory is the hardest one because you have no infrastructure, and then you can build from that. So
exactly.
Interesting. Well, we're going to find out a bit more about the work that you do in the course of the show, because we're going to be talking this week about concepts around data and specifically about ideas of data quality. So let's crack on. There is an often heard metaphor in the world of, well, basically selling big systems, as far as I can tell, which is the one that says the data is the new oil. And I think, as we've discussed on the program in the past, I think that there's an interesting corollary for that metaphor, which is actually data is more like the new nuclear waste, that the more of it, that you have, rather than just producing endless wealth for you, actually you're just increasing and increasing and increasing the risk associated with it. And partly that's because of the risks of, well, I guess, you know, the risk of losing some of it, or the risk of not being able to make decisions because you've got too much of it. But I don't think it's something that we've really talked about very much on the show over the years has been the risk of it just simply being wrong, and being wrong because of the management of data quality in an organisation. Probably helps just to be able to, just a little bit of context for Soda, Martin, if you could just tell us a little bit about what it is that you do, just because that gives a bit of understanding then about the perspective that you come from. So the products and services that you have, just the kind of the brief pitch of them.
Yeah, sure. So in the end, we help data teams create reliable, high quality data sets. That's pretty much what we focus on. And we help that by bringing kind of a workflow in place, a workflow that data teams can adopt to find, analyze and resolve issues. So a structured way to get ahead of the problem, know that it's there, then analyze it very quickly, see who needs to get involved, and then start a resolution workflow. And somewhere in there, you got to figure out if it's a priority or not. And that's part of the process. But that's really, in the end, what we do. So it's just a set of technologies and workflows really to improve that process at companies.
Okay, so what that sounds like is essentially a platform for being able to help some elements of what an organization needs to do around data governance?
Yes, some people would definitely see that as under the remit of data governance. However, data governance is a bit of an interesting term, right? It's one of those terms that people typically tend to run away when they hear the word. They tend to shy away, they tend to like, it's gonna slow me down. It's gonna, and I think that's we don't necessarily really kind of associate much with that word. What we really look at the audience, for example, we think about the engineer, the data engineer, or the analytics engineer, and then really think about terms that resonate for them. And if you think about the data engineer, well, very often that's a software engineer that rolled into data somehow. There's many fun stories there. And what they do know is things like site reliability engineering, things like DevOps, where we build and maintain. So we do the operations. So concepts like data reliability and data reliability engineering are much more, I think, palatable or much more like crisp and easy to understand and step into. And it doesn't come from like a big slide deck from the top, like we need to do this. No, it's like something you can do yourself starting tomorrow. And that's kind of how we've dealt with that in the past. So yes, data governance with a pinch of salt, I guess. It does help in the grander scheme of things, for it's about the right thing to do when it comes to data, right? And reliability engineering is definitely part of that. Quality management is definitely part of that. But you need to make sure in the end that individuals feel empowered, they feel like, you know, they're contributing in the right way, they're not held back, it makes sense for them. I think those are concepts that we really try to be very cognizant of and zoom into.
It's the, I think the journey that a number of organizations are going on, where initially data was just not seen as being anything of any particular note other than the stuff that sits in systems. And then you get to a point where to start to see an understanding that actually maybe the system alone isn't the thing that has value. It's actually obviously transactions and processes that surround it, but also that the data within it needs to have reliability for everything else to work. I find remarkable how many organizations still really haven't got their heads around that. And I also wonder whether the rise of data science as this big kind of buzz in the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, has also helped detract from some of that, because it's all become the focus of the, you know, the opportunity, without really thinking about the, yeah, but have you got robustness underpinning what you're doing?
Yes, I was. I joined kind of the data space community a good 10 years, and I was pretty front, like front row seat when it came to kind of data science popping up, and it just kept going through my head. Like we don't have, you don't have the data for it. Like you don't know what data you have. You don't have it defined. Like people mean different things. They don't know where to go and get it. Not necessarily. They don't know who to go and ask if they have a question. They don't know if we, you know, that data typically it sits in an operational system, right? So first, of course, firstly, it's like a transactional system or what have you. Legacy systems treat it as exhaust, really. They treat it as something. They kind of manipulate the structure for the internal mechanics of the application to work, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's analytics ready. So there were a lot of things. Like even today, there are still a number of companies that don't have a good grip on that, on kind of the map of what data we have, and which of course makes anything you do beyond that extremely challenging. But I think we're getting there. We're seeing a number of interesting flows. Like one is like this massive influx of engineers coming into this space is really helping out. Like they're bringing a lot of practices and ideas from software engineering or from infrastructure management or from like different layers of the stack, of the software stack into that space. So I think that's something that's very interesting that's going on right now. And yeah, it's kind of the data engineer is a bit more like the hot job right now as opposed to the data scientist or statistician from a couple of years ago. So yeah, I think in a couple of years from now it will be another role as we're kind of learning and saying, well, wow, this is a big problem or this is a big opportunity, you know. But I think companies are making progress quite quickly, especially the ones that were like a lot of companies that were just built in a time where data was not exhaust. They are doing things quite differently, and of course they still have their challenges. It's still to some extent an an not fully discovered area. Like, it's not very mature. So there's still a lot of mistakes and a lot of problems, but it's getting there. It's getting there.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'd agree with a lot of that, Martin, and certainly about the way that companies aren't often really in control of what they're doing with data, and often they're asking the wrong questions, right? They're focusing on the output of systems in a very kind of macro way and saying, oh, we want to be able to see our data like this, but they're not actually asking the questions about, you know, what are the decisions we need to make, what information do we need to have to hand to make those decisions, and what is the timeliness of the data that we need to make that decision? How regularly do we make those decisions, and how do we need to see it to make a decision? Right, because you can have all the greatest data and the greatest, you have the latest data up to the minute, but if you don't visualize it well, you'll still make bad decisions because you aren't seeing the data in the right context. So we get very hung up about, are we collecting the, you know, enough information, and could we have this or could we have that? But I think organizations, until they have a sense of what questions they're trying to answer and can articulate that in a way that makes sense. And I think that's part of this data scientist, data engineer role now, isn't it? To be aware of that question and to be able to articulate or help the business operations people to articulate what it is they actually need to do, you know, what's the outcome they need. And when that's in place, when people start to value the data they're getting, or they value the fact that they can ask for other things and they can test hypotheses about data and they can test new ways of working, they start to value the data they're collecting as well. They start to value the data that goes in. And then you get a kind of positive data culture that feeds itself. But if you're always considering it some sort of resource that has to be, that you have just to gather more and more of, then it never really gets any respect in that sense, I find.
This is, to me, if we would kind of go back 10 years, like, what is one of the biggest mistakes we've made in data? It's this notion of we have to, like, data is the strategic asset, right? We have to put a lot of processes in place around all of our data. And that's where it starts immediately on the wrong foot. Like, there's so much stuff there. You don't even know what you're using. You don't even know why you're using it anymore, why it's still running. And you want to govern and control all of that. And the regulators are, yes, you have to do this after financial crisis. It's a great way to create jobs in the end, right? In financial services, like, you could control all your data. But it's also a great way to get people frustrated, to lose people. We've never really, and that's what I really like about what you just said, Chris, is that you always need to think about what is it that we're doing with it. In our lingo, we call that the data product. Like, if you don't know what you exactly, like, you're building a product for some consumer in your company, right? Or external to the company, whether it's an analyst, whether it's a scientist, whether it's a consumer or user of you're building a product and service for those people that's data driven. So you need to know that very well. And it's that piece that you need to control and govern. It's that usage in the end. It is not everything that you've collected in the past. And then it all of a sudden becomes like, whew, okay, that's something we can do. And actually, if we do that with some simple tools that everyone can pick up and that it kind of makes sense what to do, then we have a whole different story, I think.
That's interesting, that idea, almost that you need to have a value proposition for the data that you are creating and storing.
Yep.
And for many years now, there's been an imbalance in that the people who have to do the work to be able to create and maintain the data aren't the people who see the value from the data. Or, I mean, the worst case is where you have loads of data that is stored just because that's data that we've always stored, and nobody ever questions, well, you know, do we need it? Well, we might do in the future, so therefore carry on doing it. And the costs associated with that, and the volume of activity that's associated with that. I do wonder as well, though, if a little bit like, actually, if we sort of take to contemporary events and the way in which we're starting to see a lot of misinformation going around the internet at the moment, not because it's been fed through bad intent, But things that, you know, the kind of viral images of stuff that everybody goes, oh, that's thing, and it's actually not true. It's images that are old, or it's things that have been dropped in out of complete context, and that there's a willingness for us to accept visualization of data without actually asking the questions about the provenance of the information that we're seeing. In the same way that you get the spreadsheet that goes around the organisation that's saying, look what's happening to our sales figures, and there's a compelling story to be had with nobody actually challenging to say, but what's the provenance of the data? Where has this data come from? And that kind of superficial, I don't know, the kind of dashboard mentality that has surrounded data for many years in organisations, which has actually stupefied people. It's unless it's going to be just distilled down into red, amber or green, I can't accept it. It just needs to be simplified. And so therefore, actually, the complexity underneath is obscured, but the ability for people to understand whether any of it is truthful or not is also obscured. And I don't know, that feels like we maybe have created in many organisations a culture that could be really quite dangerous, with really bad decisions being made on the back of crap.
Yeah, it's possible, and I see your point. Like, not everyone asks critical questions when they see any dashboards. It's not necessarily, I think, good business analysts though, they do. It's kind of in their nature to go and dig and to kind of cross-check, and I think it's a great skill to have as an analyst, that kind of investigation work. Because in a way, as an analyst, you're going to go look at data and say, okay, maybe we need to present it at the board meeting, or the CFO or any one of the executives needs to present it next week. Let's already kind of prepare everything for it, to at least give the executive all of the inputs. But with that comes a lot of challenging and already guessing why things are a certain way. And I think that is, in the end, the type of discussion you want to have. The conversation around data is much more important, I think, than kind of analyzing the ins and the outs, I think, are all very helpful things to do. But it would be great if there is a world in which, you know, you get a report or you get some data, and that there's, and even online, like even if it's sharing images, or that there's some form of score being given automatically based on whatever, image metadata, based on whatever that may be, right? A whole bunch of information that can kind of say, hey, you know, and we see some of that already in Twitter and on these platforms a little bit. Having the same thing in companies could be, you know, assisting you whether or not you should trust. It's still maybe dangerous, but it could be a tool that helps out as well, or helps people get more confident when they see something new. Thinking out loud.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot to that, but I think the question is in a business, you know, who's asking the questions about whether this data is good or not? That's the problem, because I've seen this happen so many times. So, and it reminds me of, you know, you see that if you look on LinkedIn or Facebook, every now and again you'll see that picture of the wolves where the there's some out in the front or something, or there's some at the back, I can't remember. But anyway, there's some story about the fact that the wolves are looking after each other, and it's all nonsense. But when you point that out, or if somebody points it out, you'll see that in the comments, oh, this picture doesn't... And actually, people will then get quite cross about that and say, well, it doesn't really matter whether it's true or not. It's the point, you know, it's the story that matters. And this is the case in business, where people often don't want to know that what you're looking at is inaccurate, because it's telling them what they want to hear. And when we see organisations, and some of the industries that I've worked in the past, where we've had organisations that have lost, you know, billions of pounds from their market capital because they were making decisions based on lies, or they were actually defrauding their customers. So you look at G4S and Serco in the UK, who got, you know, that they were charging money for tags on prisoners and offenders and people on probation, and it turned out that they were doing it incorrectly. It's not because the leaders of those companies deliberately wanted to defraud the government, but in many organisations, especially big organisations, if a chief exec gets five reports from five divisions of his company, and four of them are in profit and one of them's not making profit, you dig into the one that's not making profit. You don't dig into the ones that that are telling you they are. And that's the question for me, is how do we educate the leadership to say what you need is maybe, Martin, that kind of thing that you've been talking about. So, you know, a score on the data you get to say, can I, if I were to ask, get through the lineage of this data to find out where it comes from, if you're telling me I've made a pound, can you tell me that it's 2.50 pence, or if it's 25 pences, or if it's 52 pences that make that pound up? Or is it just, is there no way to get back to that data lineage? But until people ask for that, until the culture becomes such that they know they need to be able to do it, should they need to, then maybe those questions don't get asked. And it's up to us, whether we're in technology leadership roles or advisory roles or evangelists in the market, to show those organisations what is possible, what could be possible, and what they really need to be asking for.
Exactly. Yeah, it's all about the showing what's possible. It's about the literacy around data. This is very new for many of us, and we don't know. Like many haven't seen the state of the art, and the state of the art is actually going super quickly. It's almost impossible to keep up. So, but yeah, I've personally been in a situation you described where it was, you couldn't challenge the data. It was like, wow, that's dangerous culture. Like, if we cannot have an open discussion about, like, and looking at different angles and making sure that's happening on leadership level as well, I think this is partially bad culture. And then the other part is kind of understanding what's possible and kind of training everyone and enabling everyone to be, you know, better with data in the end. Yeah, I think there's very few times really malintent or it can be political as well, right? So if somebody really wants to make a point, you know, and the data so happens to, you know, potentially guide everyone else in that direction. This is ethics in the end. So it's like, you know, if you have a car and you go to maybe the analogy is not great, but you know, you get your car repaired and then you don't know anything about the car, but then your bill is super long and you don't understand it. Like ultimately the car maker, you know, can actually bill you the wrong thing and you will never know. In very few cases, somebody would figure that out. So it's kind of ethics in that field or ethics in data. We ultimately need to behave in an ethical way when we use data. And it's kind of still, to some extent, not fully understood or defined, I guess.
No, that's right. There's an old saying you might have heard before about somebody using statistics like a drunk uses a lamppost. It's more for support than illumination, and that's the problem that we end up with people. Essentially, you're right. You know, they're trying to justify a decision based on selective use of data, and the question is how do we know when that's happening? You know, can we arm ourselves? Can I, as a chief exec, arm myself with the tools and the knowledge to say, actually, what I'm being presented with is actually in context, or it's been quoted out of context or whatever. And maybe that's a long way off, but I'm optimistic actually that the technology is advancing at a level that we can get there at some point.
I think so. I think it's a good practice if you're sharing reports, for example, for the board or for EXCO, that you have, for everything that you share, that you have, like, I don't know, it's a QR code or it's a link where you can actually go and learn more. This is where that data comes from. This is how we got to that decision, where it kind of the entire narrative is. I think there's small things like that that can just make a whole a world of difference, really.
Yeah, it's a bit like if you get a delivery from Amazon or DHL or wherever, and they say, oh, it's going to be delivered this afternoon. And if you trust that business, and every time you order from that business, they tend to get it right, then you don't click any further. But exactly. if you haven't worked with that business before, you might go into the tracking and it will say, okay, it was delivered to this depot at this time, it's out for delivery, you're 10 stops away or something. And then that gives you comfort that actually it's going to be delivered. But after a while, you're not going to look at that, right? Because after a while, you've got the trust to know that this this company delivers when they say they're going to deliver, and you don't need the backing data. You trust that they've got it right. And that's the same with these decisions. When you're working with people, you can say, actually, this person is going to give me good information. I've got to the point where I can rely on them. But I know that if I want to, I can dig into it and I can find out where that data comes from. And that's the step that I think a lot of we're still missing in a lot of examples.
Yep, I fully agree.
It's interesting from that perspective as to whether this will be used in a way to be able to hold partners and suppliers to account as much as being able to test the quality of data within an organisation. So if you're receiving data from key suppliers about part of their supply chain for you, you're kind of at their beck and call at the moment as to whether that data is right or not and whether that they are doing the right thing or, I mean, again, I don't think it's necessarily out there to actually cause you harm, but there could well be issues with the way in which data was generated, collected, distributed that means that you're not getting the right stuff because, you know, miscalculation along the route. I mean, I've just experienced something of that in our organisation in the last few weeks, and that actually how are you able to be able to test the data that is coming into your organisation if you're not the source of it all, and as interfacing and the APIs between organisations become increasingly important, almost like, I don't know, the way in which we would test, you know, water supply, or the way in which we would test, you know, other commodities coming in to make sure that the sampling every so often to make sure that the quality is what it should be.
Exactly. Yeah, this is not a practice. It's one of the things that we're advocating, of course. That's for us, like, it's unreal how, like, in data, we don't have the same types of processes and systems like we have in other kind of either parts of the stack or in supply chain. Or if today you would ask a company that's, let's say it's an asset management company, they're relying on Bloomberg data or relying on nowadays ESG, environmental, sustainable and governance data, which is like it's a very hot topic in asset management. Ask them how many actually have a contract in place with their key providers that is enforceable. So each time new data comes in, it's checked for 30, 40, 50 different things that is important for the asset manager. I will very likely 90, 95, almost nobody has that. It's something like it's complicated to do. It doesn't really exist in a commoditized way. So it's just not happening. Even testing data, like you should test data before you use it. Like, or if you're building a product, like ultimately it's part of delivering a good experience, but these concepts are not fully adopted yet. So in a way, the data space is lagging years behind like software, the software space. But I think that will pick up rather quickly. Again, like so many people's, every company is now looking at ways to differentiate, to do their business operations better. Many companies are partially becoming software companies in that, and data companies in that transformation. So I think that the pace of learning and kind of what the state of the art is growing quite quickly now. It's improving very quickly. So I have very high hopes, but it's still a bit the Wild West today, I have to say.
Well, thank you, Martin. If people want to find out more about what you guys are up to, what can they do?
Well, the easiest way is go to soda.io. That's our homepage. From there on, if you're a bit technical and you like tinkering, I would say go look for our page on GitHub. We have a large piece of our offering is open source, open core. And if you want to dive deeper, you can access our cloud product. There's also a wealth of information. There's a blog. We blog every 2 weeks or so. We have a podcast, Data Dream Team, as well on Spotify. So yeah, there's a lot of resources where you can go follow or get involved.
Fabulous. And what does the week ahead have in store for you?
Well, for me, it's tomorrow Amsterdam. We're onboarding. It's the first of the month, so onboarding new people. And then we have strategic offsites on Thursday. And then Thursday evening, I have a red eye to Kenya. So I'll be joining. I'll be enjoying 10 days of holiday over there.
That sounds well-deserved. Fabulous stuff. Chris, how about you? What's your week ahead looking like?
Well, it's a little bit hard to say, actually. I've got a few things in the diary that may or may not come off, but it looks like I'm going to London tomorrow evening just for a few hours, just to catch up with some people, and then maybe something on Thursday, but I can't remember quite what that is. But other than that, I've got quite a lot of work to do to catch up with from last week, because it was quite busy last week. So we've got new, well, clients that have got advisory service recently, where when we onboard people, we spend quite a lot of time getting to know them and really trying to understand their situation. And that's when the rubber hits the road, really, because then you start to have interesting and more in detail conversations about the things that they've got going on, because it takes a while for people to trust you in many ways, because they don't really know what value they can get from you. So yeah, we've got quite a lot of that going on, which is good, because that's really where the interesting part of this job is. So yeah, looking forward to that. Plenty to get on with.
I'm supposed tomorrow to be going to an event that Julia Hobsbawm is organising, where I believe Rory Sutherland is speaking. But it's all a little bit dependent on there being the ability to cross from one side of London to the other, because there is supposedly tube strikes tomorrow, and apparently they're talking about in terms of everything being shut. So that is a delight to look forward to. Other than that, the usual work stuff, I've got a little side project on at the moment to create a new game, which I am doing a bit of tweaking on, which is, funnily enough, it's about what data to use when for what sorts of decisions, which is it's an interesting model that a client has created, and I'm working on a little card game, as is my wont for it. So I'll do a bit more tweaking on that. And yeah, trying to avoid becoming completely consumed by reading the news in an endless spiral of scariness. So yeah, we'll see how that goes. So that brings us to the end of yet another show. Next week we have who, Chris?
We have Chris Chapman, who works for a company that does remote events, and of course that whole business has leapt in relevance in the last couple of years. So it'll be good to talk to Chris.
Fabulous. Look forward to that. Martin, once again, thank you for joining us on the show this week.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Chris, I will see you with the other Chris next week.
Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find us on the internet at wb40podcast.com, on Twitter at wb40podcast, and on all good podcast platforms.